top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
I want people to really see what's going on in here. I can't believe they're experimenting on endangered species like these.
Exactly what kind of work do you do here?
I do genetic research.
I'm gonna do the intro to the story. Is this dog an innocent victim? And this doggy, Max!
I want Max back. We're not talking about a street mutt here. We are talking about a $1 million research animal.
Thank you, Max. Sweet.
See, Max is not your typical dog. He's a genetic crossbreed.
Get him, Max! Sick him!
Enhanced sight, hearing, strength, stamina. The ability to climb with jaguar-like agility. Even a chameleon-like capability to camouflage itself if threatened.
Give me your breath!
Get him!
But in the right hands, Max can save thousands of lives. In the wrong hands, he can be a deadly weapon.
We're in big trouble.
He's coming apart.
No!
He is gonna snap!
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 274, Man's Best Friend. So, from New Line Cinema, the house that Freddy built, we have a house that was built upon the foundation of what, Fido, for this one? Man's Best Friend. We're entering into our favorite territory, animal attack films. And Man's Best Friend, as the title suggests, obviously, about dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And so in our discussion, we can touch
on... I thought this was about you.
I'm a friend to everyone.
You're one of my best friends.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
You're this man's best friend.
Yeah.
Here, let's cheers to that.
Yeah. So dogs. There's also the movie Dogs from 1976.
And there are a lot of movies that are dogs, many of which we've talked about on the podcast.
It's true.
Yeah.
So it's nice to talk about a dog that's not a dog.
Well, it's a dog, but the movie's not a dog.
This is
like an Abbott and Costello routine already.
Yeah, or like an airplane, what's your Vector Victor routine.
Right.
We're so happy that we got this movie sent to us because this is an overlooked 90s gem that I'm embarrassed to admit I'd never heard of.
Nor did I, and thank you, DM, for saying this one to us. This is definitely something that we both, I think, needed in our lives without knowing that we did. And you were saying about New Line Cinema and the house that Freddie built, or is this the house that Fido built? Well, actually, this is the house that Max built, because, yeah, this is Man's Best Friend from 1993, and this is a film about a genetically engineered, super-powered, weaponized canine.
Indeed, and a weird choice of breed, I would say, for weaponization. I would think the go-to ones would be Doberman,
German Shepherd,
Pitbull.
Yep.
Those are the obvious ones. But
not
this,
the rapper, of course. But
the I think he's pretty genetically modified.
Is he even a rapper? I don't even know what he is.
I think he's a motivational speaker. It always sounds bad. That Latin cum bottle popping. Like rap douchebag.
Well, he's Mr. Worldwide, and that's all I know. So
he's a man of the world. He's a global citizen. You'd think not a Tibetan Mastiff, which is what this dog is, which is like a, as the name suggests, like a mountain rescue dog that I think is a shepherd as well. But you don't associate something this cute mm-hmm. with the big, wonderful anthropomorphic eyebrows, like looking at you. It's such a sweet dog. Yeah. You can't help but fall in love with.
Oh,
as you
I
mentioned,
know the cute wet nose, yeah. the lolling tongue, you know? Those eyes you could just peer into their soul. The fluffy mane.
Mm.
Max,
would you like
all.
To be alone? It's waxing poetic. No, I, you know, both of us love dogs. You had one as a child.
I've had many, but yeah.
And mm-hmm. my God, like, you can't help but be just moved by a movie like this, and a movie that tonally invests so much in its antagonist to the point where you're rooting for the antagonist in a way you really don't with, let's say, Dogs, which was a genetic experiment gone awry, affecting a pack of dogs mm-hmm. as opposed to just one.
Well, it's interesting because I recently revisited one of our mutual favorites, Day of the Animals. And, I mean, that's basically Hot Shot, right? I know.
Yeah, it's a callback to Leslie Nielsen in Airplane.
Totally,
yeah,
totally.
Hot Shot.
And, I mean, that's a movie where, you know, animals are attacking en masse. I mean, there's no there's no specificity. Yeah. I mean, it's just basically all the animals in the animal kingdom are just attacking. And as hateful and as dislikable as many of the characters are, you still, and I'm looking at you, Leslie Nielsen Hotshot, right? You know, Mr. Advertising Whiz Executive, yeah. what have you, but you know, you never find yourself rooting for the animals. You find yourself rooting for the Homo sapiens, right? Mm-hmm. The humans to come out on top. Whereas in this one, you really are rooting for Max. Now, is that because of the inherent unlikability of the human characters? Is that because Max is just so darn cute? Is that because the movie's just so silly in so many ways, but in such a lovable sense of the word? I don't know, but we definitely find ourselves rooting for Max, who I guess would be the prize of the Emax Corporation.
Yeah, he personifies the brand, if you will. I mean, he puts the Max in Emax, and this corporation is run by.
Now he's not Max Power.
No, but it's pretty powerful.
But he is powerful. He's powerful Max, not Max Power, right?
It's run by a character who throws all,
caution to the wind.
Caution to the wind when it comes to sartorial choices and tends to favor the good old Canadian tuxedo, even though he's the CEO and head researcher of Emax, and that is the character whose name escapes me, and I'm sure with your copious... Dr. Jarrett.
I did write it down.
Indeed. Well, played by genre favorite, I mean, Alien, Pumpkinhead, there's some awful show, Millennium or something. He was like a psychic on some bad Fox show. Lance, the Scar Henriksen himself.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, this is a genre icon. I mean, you mentioned Aliens, you mentioned Pumpkinhead. Another one that you didn't mention is probably my favorite Lance Henriksen performance in what probably one of my all-time favorite vampire films, Near Dark.
Yes.
I mean, the man is one of those treasures. Every time you see him in a movie, you know that whether the movie is going to be good, bad, or indifferent, you're going to at least enjoy seeing Lance Henriksen in the film. He lends a certain credence, a certain gravitas to a movie just by virtue of him being in it.
A certain emaciated, skeletal, not exactly leading man kind of looks.
He's got I mean, there's something very Carradine-esque about him, I find. You mm-hmm. know, he kind of reminds me a bit of David Carradine.
Very gaunt, cheekbones, yeah, mm-hmm. high cheekbones.
They're guys that looked about 20 years or senior, no matter what stage of their career they're in. I saw a movie recently with Lance Henriksen, not a good movie at all. And I don't know, how old must he be now, would you say?
Got to be mid-60s.
He looked about 80, so yeah. And this one he was probably in his...
His face looks like a catcher's mitt.
Yeah. And so, I mean, Lance Henriksen is somebody that we always appreciate in films, but this was certainly not one of his liveliest performances. I mean, the man could barely be sus to change his outfit, let alone put in any sort of emotive performance in this entire movie.
It's true. The odd raised eyebrow here and there and some, outlining his frustration with the local authorities, and that's really about it. A bunch of yelling. And
this is a guy, as you mentioned before, he's a gifted genetic researcher. He's a leading mind in the scientific community, and he's a captain of industry, and yet he spends the entire movie wearing this really sort of nondescript denim jacket looking no more important than the guy asking me for a quarter every time I leave my apartment. So, yeah.
That guy's been a fixture of your neighborhood for years, let me say.
Yeah, he has. Actually, they actually kind of look a little similar.
They do. Of it. I think eventually every hobo and transient manages somehow to end up looking like Lance Henriksen. This is funny, this movie, because it launches...
Is that what you learned from this movie?
Oh, well, I'm going to have to hold that one off. This one features, I mean, I love pets, I love dogs, but also my other love, which is journalism. So I was just thrilled to bits to watch this muckraking journalist played by, of all people, Ali Sheedy.
Ali Sheedy.
With this, yep. You know, very fetching, you know, a chic short do. And she's on the lookout for a story. And of course...
And a very 90s, early 90s pantsuit.
Oh,
you
know, yeah, of course. Yep. And she, I forget how she's tipped off about the transgressions that may be transpiring in this particular research lab. It's been a while since I've seen this, but her and her producer, indefatigable producer with the electronic news gathering equipment, they decide to bust into the place and get a story. Well, she'll do anything for a story.
As a movie... begins, yes, we are introduced to Ali Sheedy's character, Lori Tanner, and she's a journalist that, to me, it sort of reminds me of like a current affairs type program, you know, that sort of news magazine show in the early 90s.
Yeah, with a long list of retractions, like they parodied on The Simpsons.
Exactly.
Muckraking, yeah.
And she wants to sort of make a name for herself by exposing a big, big story.
As do I. I haven't yet as a journalist.
And she's... She gets a source, a whistleblower, who's working at this aforementioned Emacs research. And this whistleblower's name is Judy Sanders. And they're on the phone, and the employee wants to expose the animal cruelty that is occurring at Emacs. And so they're on the phone, and she's like, okay, if you come by at this time and you give me so much money, what have you, I'll let you in after hours, and you can see what's going to be going on. Now, unfortunately... Poor Judy is not long for this earth, because what we get afterwards is a POV shot, not from Michael Myers or some other serial killer, but from a dog.
Yo, that's great stuff. Now, probably cinema first.
I was going to say, now, I don't know if this is the first time that we've gotten a dog POV. I would have to go back and rewatch all those Animal Attack movies, but I don't recall it being a common fixture. So, yeah, I'm going to say this could be very well one of the first animal POVs. Max does kill Judy.
And it's a good thing, too, because with, you know, the resources available to journalists these days, and in those days, they might not have been able to pay the woman to get that story as well. And shame on her for demanding money in exchange for a scoop. But anyway, that's another story.
Her and her producer were discussing about, you know, the fact that they were doing the story on spec. In other words, they were... Nobody had commissioned them to do this story. This was something they were going to do surreptitiously in order to blow the lid off this research corporation, which seems to exist in every small town USA, in every city, whether it be in the late 80s, early 90s.
Oh, of course.
And she's determined. When her source goes belly up and is not there at the aforementioned meeting place, she's undeterred. She is going to go in there with her producer and... look around and see what the heck is going on in this facility. And what they see is not exactly, I mean, for an animal lover like myself, I mean,
it's
there's
not on the up and up.
Not on the up and up. I mean, there's animals that are tossed unceremoniously in garbage cans. There's a monkey named Goner. I mean, what kind of name is that to give to a monkey?
Apt, I would say. Yeah.
There's another one reminding me of what was served as the second course of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Oh,
a monkey with their head lopped off, their brain exposed, etc. And that's not even talking about the special projects room. And in that special projects room is where they have all the endangered species like bears and tigers and so on and so forth.
So I was wondering if I was going to make a very personal disclosure regarding animal research, but okay, what the hell.
Yeah, go ahead.
At University of Toronto, I was part of what was called a psychobiology lab. And when I saw this monkey with this exposed brain, we actually, in third year, sophomore, whatever, we actually did psychosurgeries where we would...
Psychocircus?
Psychocircus, at a Kiss album of little renown. Or maybe much renown for you because you love all things Kiss.
But no, not all things Kiss. It's really not that one. But anyway.
We mapped out a rat's... motor cortex by drilling into its skull and stimulating its brain with electrodes. Now, I'm no fan of rats. I was actually bitten in the lab, necessitating shots to get thereafter, but it was that experience that led me to conclude that really animal research is not for me, even though I appreciate its many benefits to mankind. But that sort of struck a chord when I saw poor Goner. I was going to ask you, like, what were those animals involved in? We know Max was made to be a super dog, but what about, like, the poor circus bear or the tiger? What were they doing?
Oh, they were all basically a bouillabaisse in order to create Max.
Oh, yes,
right?
Of course.
Yeah,
because
they were taking all the inherent skills of each animal and placing it into this one super animal named Max. So, I mean, it was given...
Oh, so it has the strength of a bear, the agility of a tiger.
The agility of a tiger, the chameleonic abilities of the chameleon.
But, okay, why would you put all these things into a creature that's not exactly known for its speed, like, and killing ability? Wouldn't you take...
The element of surprise, I guess.
I guess, but a pit bull you'd think would be much more suited to that, or even maybe make a A greyhound more vicious because it's super fast and can catch you.
You know what, Chris? Now that you said that, how remiss is Emax by not putting the power of the groundhog in Max? Can you imagine if, in addition to everything that this animal could do, he also would have had the ability to prognosticate the coming of spring? That would have been something
that
else.
That would be something else.
Then you would have really had a super weapon on your hands.
Oh my God. Since this movie is in the distant memory, I'm really grateful for your...
How long ago did you watch this? Like a month?
It was a good week and a half.
Okay.
But yeah, that is extremely funny, and the dog comes with it. All sorts of incredible powers.
Well, the dog, when they first see him, I mean, the poor, you know, he's affixed with this giant apparatus, this device of some sort, which to me looked like almost like one of those Texas Instruments calculators you would have seen in, like, Radio Shack in 1982.
Yeah.
I mean, speaking of, like, you know, hybrids and so on, so it was like a calculator crossed with a speak and spell. It was this crazy apparatus.
Oh, if I'm not mistaken, he could respond to commands in, Arabic and Mandarin as well? He was a multilingual dog as well.
Max was able to do a lot of things. But, unfortunately, he was also part of the quote-unquote billion-dollar vivisection industry.
Hmm.
And Ali Sheedy, or Lori as she is, did not take too kindly to that and ends up absconding with what they call a 600-pound dog. This dog did not look 600 pounds. This was
well,
a
maybe
small dog.
At the combined weight of the five dogs that played Max in the film, it would be 600. But
that sounds like, you know, an old time wrestling guy, you know?
Yeah.
And coming down the aisle at a combined weight of 748 pounds. Why a combined weight? Why was that important to know? You're only fighting one guy at a time. So
it's true, and yeah. They always match them in terms of weight and height. So you never see some midget. Well, I guess they did in some cases bring a midget in, but these guys were like. Team, what, Demolition,
like,
Axe and Smash, both big guys?
I'm just remembering, like, King Kong Bunny and Big John Studd, like, you know, in a combined weight of 1,273 pounds.
Oh, crap.
Know?
Which I think was off, but...
And this at this point, I think this is the time for you to talk about your gripe with the parts unknown part of...
Part of wrestling?
Yeah.
Well, of course. It bothered me like Santa Claus bothered me, with all so many loose ends that could not be tied together. If these wrestlers were from parts unknown, how did they sign a contract?
There you go. Where did they send the checks to?
Oh, I suppose. In current day, they could just PayPal them or whatever. But still, stands to reason, they would have territorial rights to sign over to these guys, you know, within which they would be allowed to operate.
Mm-hmm.
Never sat well with me, the parts unknown.
Didn't bother me that much, but anyhow, this is a good little, this is sort of like a segue, just to very, very quickly talk about Ali Sheedy. Now, it's funny because many of us, people of our vintage, grew up with Ali Sheedy because she was part of the Brat Pack, right? And she starred in, you know, classic movies like The Breakfast Club.
Yeah, The Goth, The Wonderful Goth.
St. Elmo's Fire, etc. War Games. Now, I'm going to tell you right now that I, as a cinemaphile... who has never seen a Brat Pack movie. I know, the look you're giving me
You've
right now.
You've not seen Breakfast Club.
I've never seen the Breakfast Club. I've never
that
seen...
That was on television, on Fox, I would have to say for a decade.
See, that's
every
why
Sunday.
Fox, don't forget, like, TBS. I mean,
oh, yeah, yeah.
That is why, and it's been referenced so many times, right, that I feel like I've seen these movies without seeing them, because I would just be flipping through the dial and I would see a scene here, a scene there, and I would just, over about a decade, I would piecemeal the movie together and feel like I've seen it. But I've never sat down and watched St. Elmo's Fire, 16 Candles, Pretty in Pink, The Breakfast Club. I've not seen any of those movies. And whenever I mention it, just like the look you were giving me just a moment ago, I get that same look each and every time.
Well, I could see 16 Candles because it's maybe like more female-centric, and you could say, oh, it's a woman's coming of age. It might not be of interest. But, I mean, just with that incredible cast, Breakfast Club, and the iconic, like, dance scene.
And Simple Mind just, song and everything. Yeah, yeah, for sure. I know.
But it's interesting how different Sheedy looks in this movie versus that. I mean, she just really came into her own, and she's sporting this like kind of chic do. And in that movie, she was this... well, I don't know if she uttered a word, if I'm not mistaken.
I can't confirm nor deny. I haven't seen it, but...
It's highly worth your time, because every character in it is an embodiment of the timeless high school stereotype, mm-hmm. which I found wonderful. So Judd Nelson is the burnout. Emilio Estevez is the jock, as she plays the goth. Like, every single one of them is, these things will never change.
Is Molly Ringwald the nerd or the
she's the goody two-shoes rich chick. Okay. And then Anthony Michael Hall is the nerd. These things will never change. But yeah, well, it's well worth checking out. It's just an amazing movie.
It's
and
funny
you can't
because
help but fall for her in that movie.
They say, you know, I mean, the big theme song that come out of The Breakfast Club is "Don't You Forget About Me." You seem to have forgotten about this movie quite quickly. But I will say that when it comes to Ally Sheedy, the one film that I did see her in the 80s that is near and dear to my heart is Short Circuit. She was in the original Short Circuit with another actor that sort of kind of fell off the map but is making a bit of a comeback lately, Steve Guttenberg. And then they sort of had a very brief voiceover type role in the tangential sequel that was filmed here in Toronto, which I actually like better. Short Circuit 2, incredible.
Uh-huh.
But yeah,
I've seen both in the cinema. I can't remember a single thing other than it was some robot that went misfired, which was a trend in the 80s. Robots misfiring was a thing all over the place.
Well, in a sense, I mean, no, I was going to say Max is a robot, but he's not really a robot. He's a
he's a trans species. He kind of is, you know, he is, and he's combined all these different attributes of these, so, I mean, genetically modified foods are en vogue right now about all these concerns about that, but this is a genetically modified animal, and his powers are so incredible that when he's taken home by Ally Sheedy's character, when she makes this, you know, journalistic gotcha scoop, she is so taken with Max, as were we, that she takes him home, but Max cannot be controlled in her, you know, modest abode. I mean, this thing is a ferocious creature. It will not be, I mean...
But is it really? Like, that's the thing it is kind of funny, because...
He answers to her, and because she serves the function of the alpha male.
Right.
That dog is pissed at all her lovers, anyone who comes into close contact with her, and she cannot hold it. And as much as she tries, it causes a lot of friction between her and her beau. This thing has a mind of its own. It's got, if I'm not mistaken, there's a timeline given where it has some sort of, you're going to have to fill me in with the details, but it has like 24 hours before it goes apeshit. It's not really well explained.
I mean, Lance Henriksen, when Dr. Jarrett, when he's being questioned by the police because, you know, he's talking about, okay, there was a break-in in my... facility and my dog
is
missing.
Yeah, experimental, you know, creatures is missing. Yeah.
And he's sort of giving the lowdown about Max, and he says, "Look, I mean, we've given this dog a neuropathic drug to keep him stable, and he's got 24 hours before he goes completely apeshit. At the max, no pun intended.
Well,
what's the minimum? Imminent.
Hey, this
and
stuff
yet,
is great.
Yes.
This is a screenwriter's favorite device. When you have a ticking time bomb, you have a terrorist who makes a demand that if you don't do something within 10 hours, I'm going to lop off a finger of one of the victims. Like, this is a great device. So it adds a certain, you know, pace to the movie.
But
which
at the same time...
It was well-paced anyway, but
it was,
still.
It was very well-paced, but at the same time, like, I never really... I mean, here he is saying, okay, we got it. Like, this is something... This is of the utmost urgency. Max is going to flip out. I mean, this is a weaponized dog that's a prototype of, you know, whatever's going to, like, revolutionize out of the defense industry or the guard dog industry. I think that was another thing you were talking
about.
Hey,
that's a big industry, yeah.
Exactly. Huh. And yet, yeah, I mean, he got more aggressive as the film went on, but I never really saw Max flipping out per se, except for maybe one scene, which we're going to talk about. We kind of have to talk about it, even though it is a bit of a spoiler. But yeah, I mean, Max definitely has got a temper. I mean, early on in the movie, the paperboy's coming around doing his rounds. He throws the morning edition. It hits poor Max right in the schnoz. And then the paperboy pretty much gets almost turned into kibbles and bits as a result of it.
Oh, and another, like the time-honored, not through rain nor sleet, the stupid U.S. Postal Service. There's a postal worker who has a Mexican stare down with Max and pulls out his pepper spray and like maces Max. And Max does not take kindly to that.
That was hilarious. That was phenomenal. Because first of all, you have this mailman who at first sees a new dog in the neighborhood and he figures, okay, I'm going to approach it with a little bit of friendliness. Oh, how's it going, boy? What's going on? And right away, Max starts snarling and baring his teeth.
Good portmanteau.
Exactly. And the mailman pulls out this pepper spray and sprays this inordinate amount of pepper. I've never seen...
Might have been bear spray.
I've never seen some sort of like pump propelled mechanism that sprayed that much. And it was filmed in such a way that as Max is getting doused with his pepper spray, he's kind of like moving around in slow motion. And I don't know why, but it reminded me of like a shampoo commercial or something. It was very, very strange, but to no avail, because I mean, this pepper spray didn't deter Max in the slightest.
Yeah, and he goes after the guy. He tries to hop a fence, and things do not go well for the postie. But things go even less well for
the neighborhood cat. Yes. Are we going to talk about it?
Oh, that's fantastic. I don't know if this is what we've learned, but a couple of the neighborhood kids have a problem with the local cat, saying it's mean, it scratches people, whatever. But that in no way suggests that this feline should have like all nine of its lives expunged in this one horrific event.
How do you know that feline had nine lives left? Maybe all eight had already been extinguished and this was the last life.
It is possible.
And if that was his last life, what a way to go.
This was the showstopper you texted me about. Without spoiling it, you said there's a scene in this movie I assure you you've never seen in your life, which is as true a statement as can be made. You were bang on 100% on that one. The kids... mention that this cat is, you know, miserable and scratches people, and then they actually sick Max the dog on this cat.
Yep.
And I thought, okay, yeah, once it made its way up the tree, you know...
Then the cat's safe.
Yeah.
Of course. But this was a dog that was genetically spliced with the abilities of...
A bear to climb trees.
Bears, yeah. Jungle cats, what have mm-hmm. you. And all of a sudden, these claws come out.
Not from the cat, but from the dog.
Yes.
It's really like these almost talons.
And all
of a sudden, it goes vertical and is climbing the bark with ease and catching up with this poor kitty.
I'm sort of miming that right now. And I think I'm looking a lot like Bela Lugosi and Dracula with my hands and claws.
Well, as soon as I saw these raptor-type claws come out of its paws, I thought, holy shit, I'm going to see something that Jeff described very vaguely, and oh my God.
And that would have been enough. Mm-hmm. Just the dog producing those claws and climbing up the tree
horizontally. That was audacious in of itself.
That was audacious, yeah. But what comes next is about as audaciousness as audacious can get.
Yeah, it reminded me of almost the Italian cannibal films with like the animal violence that the likes of those directors would film and pay locals to film. And this was Max consuming this poor cat in the tree canopy in a way that, I mean, it was so well done. And no one, I guarantee, saw this one coming. When you compare this to Cujo, who was, I think, bitten by a spider or an insect and went
AWOL. Was it a bat?
It's been a while.
It was exploring
subterranean territory and got bitten by something and then turned into a rabid, frothing, demonic kind of dog. But never have I seen this level of violence inflicted on another creature. Mm-hmm. So that was amazing. He swallows the cat whole. And at that point, I was like...
You're all in, man.
I was all in. I called my girlfriend in. She was taking a shower. I said, you have to see this. And then she proceeded to just watch the rest of it with me when I rewound that and said, man, this is at counterpoint and at cross purposes, at loggerheads with the tone of this movie, because this is a fairly happy-go-lucky 80s style, even though it was 93. Like, charming kind of movie. Yep. And when this happened, it took a turn that I did not see coming, and I don't know how they managed to get this out. Like, it doesn't seem like it has a Lassie almost vibe to it. It had a like a, what was it, the Beethoven series with another, I think,
with
that
Charles
was
Grodin and
A Bernese, the dog, a similar mountain dog, a similar sweet, like Beethoven's, I think they went up to Beethoven's Fifth, like
right,
da, 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 da,
well, they
of
have
course,
to,
they
course,
had to,
you know. Yeah.
And this was a sweet movie, and then as that when that happened, I was like, man, these kids are ruthless, A, and B, this dog is ruthless to swallow a cat whole. I thought, man, this is vicious, and I'm on board.
Well, you're on board, and if you think that that is the apex, that is the apotheosis, yeah, of what you're going to see in this movie that's going to make you just go, what the fuck, you are sorely mistaken, because not only is Max a fighter, not only is Max somebody who has the ability to swallow felines whole, but Max is a lover, too.
Indeed.
And to the strains of, I believe one of my fellow Canadians, Paul Anka, right? He's a Canadian.
Yeah, yep. He is indeed. He's our answer to Frank Sinatra, which I don't buy at all, but anyway. Yeah, puppy love, he actually makes it with...
He gets some literal tail in this one.
Oh, didn't... Yeah, well done. With a collie? Which seems to me like kind of an effeminate dog. And it seems like, this is awful to say, that it would always be the bottom, like, of dogs, like the... I don't know.
I'm just letting you, giving you enough rope right now, my friend. That's all.
Well, yeah, and he, you know, his charms are like impossible to resist, and he does hook up with this collie and produces.
And they call it puppy love.
And it produces offspring. It propagates the species, and that's, you know, no spoiler there, but mm-hmm. That's, you know, that factors in prominently.
Well, that
kind of
was a spoiler, but whatever.
Okay, well, yeah.
It doesn't really matter.
A very subtle one.
But yeah, lest we forget, I mean, here we have Dr. Jarrett, you know, still being questioned by the police still questioning Dr. Jarrett as to the whereabouts of the whistleblower, Judy Sanders, mm-hmm. that was taken out near the beginning, and all Lance Henriksen wants is his dog back. Now, why does he want his dog back? Is he altruistic in the sense that he knows what sort of havoc Max can wreak? No, he's not.
No.
He doesn't want it back. He wants it back because
he wants his Nobel Prize. Or
exactly.
It is, yeah.
And he also wants redemption, because Dr. Jarrett is somebody who, this was a very hoary bit of exposition that's kind of throughout, but yeah, oh, he did these experiments and he was discredited by the scientific community and he was excommunicated
and
it's gone rogue and now he's trying to... You know, he's trying to reclaim his good name by creating this this crazy guard dog hybrid. But yeah, so that's basically the movie. You have a bit of a police procedural in the sense that you have these two cops trying to figure out what the heck is going on in EMAC's research. You have Dr. Jarrett doing whatever he can to get his dog back. And you have Lori trying to...
Get her scoop, yeah.
Get her scoop and also to protect Max mm-hmm. as well. And... The whole thing, I mean, in many ways, I would say this is the literal definition of a Shaggy Dog story. Like, it really is, in the sense that there's all these elements that should not work. I mean, it's so patently silly, so ridiculous, so jaw-droppingly, I'm not going to say inane, but just like, whoa. Like,
it's tone-deaf.
Well, exactly.
Sure.
And yet, at the same time, it's so, just like most... members of the canine community. I mean, it's just so gosh darn lovable. This whole thing is just lovable from start to finish.
And is that the time to segue into what we've learned? I think it would be.
Sure.
There's a terrific scene where, like, as again, like, she's the alpha male, Lori, because she's taken Max in and he only responds really to her commands. He's not taking a shine to her bow, to say the least. He actually... bites through the boyfriend's brake lines in order to sabotage his vehicle, which I was like applauding to myself, like, with that, because it was so absurd, the level of savvy and guile
cunning
and intellect and cunning that mm-hmm. this creature possessed, and to actually know where the brake, like, hell, that's more than I could tell you. Like, someone who couldn't change oil in their car, like,
what?
It drives twice a year.
Which animal did they splice that ability into Max to know about basic auto mechanics?
I don't Amazing,
think
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
oh, yeah. phenomenal. Oh, what was interesting too. Okay, so what part, I was curious, maybe you know, what part did the chimp play in this hybrid creature? Was that where the smarts came from with its like incredible, cerebellum to body mass ratio? Like, possibly. Did it insert chimp DNA for its like cunning and agility? I don't know. I missed that part, but I thought, man, that was also hilarious. And it, when these types of movies, there's a certain tone that they try and set. And you, let's say with Piranha, sure, they could be maybe more intelligent or more voracious fish, but they're still fish and they're confined to fish abilities. But the fact that this thing climbed a tree, took out brake lines, was like leaping over fences with no with the abilities of a tiger,
leaping
really
over a whole bunch of cop cars at one point.
Oh, yeah. And for a dog that's not known for its athletic prowess, I thought that was a really funny and hilarious way to go about things. I've got another thing I've learned. This was set in, I think, San Diego or somewhere in Southern California, and they took these two Goomba cops who would not have been out of place in like Newark, New Jersey, the Brooklyn. And these guys are greasers, you know, with the holsters, you know, creating the sweaty armpits, like with the, you know, the revolver under the arm. And these guys were such fucking whops. Like, and I thought, where did these guys come from? It's like, now, Chris, is in California.
I just have to interrupt you for one second. I am not Italian. I'm not of Italian descent. So, you know, we have to qualify that you are allowed to say that word "wop" because you are Italian,
and
right?
We have no restrictions on this podcast, really. But yes, I am half, Dago, heritage. Like, I gotta say, like, for a group,
you're half Dago, half Kraut, right?
Half Dago, half Kraut. Okay. I gotta say, for a group that's not as discriminated against as other minorities, pound for pound, the Italians have the most ethnic slurs about them. Like, you can't compete with Dago, Wop, Guinea, like
greaser.
Yeah, that it's an achievement of sorts.
And then, but, of course, we got Gino as
Gino for us growing up, which was funny in a in a large part Italian school. Gino, I don't know if is that still a thing? A Gino and Gina?
Yeah.
You winked knowingly as if
My ex-wife is Italian, and
have your ear to the ground culturally. Yeah, indeed, you are a cultural soothsayer.
There was many a person that she would describe as a Gino / Gina, depending upon the gender. So
every ethnicity comes with it a sense of pride and a sense of shame. And growing up, I was always trying to differentiate myself from that crew. With their like loud Camaros and dice in the mirror and affinity for loud, garish Azuri sportswear.
And what about their house music?
Oh, my God. Yeah.
I was going to say their affinity for blaring those loud Stevie B songs from their Camaros. But yeah.
It really is amazing when you think of the Jersey Shore, because we really have that in North Toronto with Vaughan and Woodbridge
yeah.
which.
Or as I like to say, Wood the Bridge.
And it's a commuter community north of Toronto that has the moniker Wop Bridge. And these homes with these garish lion statues.
What is up with Italians and stone statues in front of the house, man?
Maybe it's a Medici thing. Like, they
it
would
have been awesome if they were like gargoyles or something. Yeah. But they're always just like really tacky lions.
And it's amazing.
Know,
regardless of
Venus
how
de Milo water features and stuff. Like,
it really is amazing. Regardless of whether the property would warrant a Botticelli or like a lion, it doesn't matter. If the property's 15 feet across, like you'd have in downtown Toronto, or 200 feet across, as you'd have in the exurbs and the suburbs, these lions, they just make their appearance. These fountains, these glorious like fountains. I don't know what it is. Like, aesthetically, yeah, maybe it's just because you're coming from the old country and you're like trying to prove that you made good in the new world. I don't know what it is. It's just completely mystifying.
By erecting a chintzy lion statue in front of your domicile? Okay, if that's what it takes.
It's pretty mysterious. But these cops were really funny. Mm-hmm. And they were straight out of The Sopranos, these kind of, again, New Jersey, you know, mortadella eating Goomba types, and they were just totally out of place in this movie. And this movie is at such cross purposes tonally. It's
a very suburban movie too.
It really is. Yeah. And it's very charming and romantic. And yet they have these violent moments. Yeah.
And you got these two cops, like you said before. I mean, it seems like they would be transplanted right out of, like, let's say, like a Larry Cohn film from the early 80s, right? Yeah. Like, it took place in
Mulberry Street, the Winged Serpent,
or
something.
Yeah, indeed. So, yeah. But yeah, lions and tigers and zebras
and bears,
and bears, oh my, and everything seemed to be spliced into Max. And yeah, Max is a one-man zoo. I mean, that's for sure.
He's a one-man wrecking crew. And oh, another thing I learned is
I'm glad you have a lot that you've learned, because I really didn't learn much.
So. I always get a kick out of when a movie references its title, because that can be for good and for bad. Mm. Usually it's to add several debits, but I thought this was funny when Dr. Jarrett uttered to the cops, as he's trying to convey to them, this is a remorseless killing machine a la Jaws. He says to them, "We're not talking about man's best friend here." And I was thinking, ding, 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 like focus group. Bam, we got all the boxes checked. Cool, that I didn't detract from me whatsoever. Man, this is just great stuff. Since you've learned nothing from the movie, or you've explained it all in detail in the preceding 40 minutes or so, let's launch into star rating. Because
let's do so.
Man, I'm going to give this 3.75, almost 4. This is a top drawer animal attack feature.
Mm-hmm.
I think it favorably holds up to genre stalwarts like Jaws and Piranha. I think this is an amazing achievement.
Well, I mean, I prefer Jaws it even, and Man's Best Friend. I mean,
yeah, Alligator too. I throw it in there because while this one doesn't bring the humor of John Sayles in that film, it definitely brings.
It brings a charm. It pulls at the heartstrings. Yeah, it does. It really does. And I mean, we do have the story as well. I mean, you know, yes, of course, Ally Sheedy does sort of play the role of the alpha male, but then there's also his young, master, who's a bit of a protectorate for Max.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that too. You got that element of a boy and his dog. So it really is a film that is tonally all over the place. And yet, not for a second is it never, I'm using a double negative there, I hope that comes out properly. Is it never?
I ain't got no time for that.
Is it never wholly entertaining? So you give this thing 3.75?
Yeah.
Having watched it twice now, I'm going to have to say that I'm going to give it 4 stars.
Wow, unbelievable.
I feel it's a must-see.
Yeah.
I feel like our listeners owe it to themselves. It's recently been re-released on Blu-ray or released on Blu-ray, I don't know. Go out there. Grab yourself a copy of Man's Best Friend, sit back and just revel in its nuttiness, its charm.
Or revel, as we say in English. Sorry, any time I get to like bust the balls and the chops of an English teacher, I'm one to do it. Because yeah, as you've been hard on me for my theory or hypothesis that you can throw a comma in anywhere. And you've tried to teach me on countless occasions. I've yet to get the comma rule. I'm terrible at it.
Just remember fanboys, Chris. It's all about the fanboys.
Okay. Yes.
Speaking of pronunciation issues, I was doing a little bit of tutoring today, mm-hmm. and I was teaching the word. This, of course, is a tangent. Respite.
But I thought people, it was respite.
That's what I was going to say. Some people say respite, right? So is it respite, respite? I said you could pronounce it both ways, and both ways are equally acceptable.
I wonder if
acceptable.
It's the King's English kind of thing where. Mm. It always bugs me when...
Because we don't say despite despot, but
no.
I've heard people say respite, and I've heard people say respite.
Well, that's funny, because whenever people in... I mean, we're colonials, of course, in Canada, but whenever I hear English people or British people admonishing us for our English and our choice of words and our vocabulary and everything, I think, man, no, screw you. Like, more people speak like us than they do over there.
Mm.
It's just the God's honest truth, and that's because of the cultural influence of American movies. Just suck it up, Buttercup. This is the way we talk.
You know? Suck it up or build me up, Buttercup.
Yeah.
Take your
so
pick.
Respite, respite, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
And I'm saying this as someone who loves the O-U-R, the flavor that we've adopted some of their spelling, and we have sort of a hybrid of American spelling and UK spelling that's very, very confusing. So you can be recognized for such a thing with a Z here, whereas in the UK it'll be with an S, and there's no rhyme or reason to it. But that is definitely a tangent.
It's tangential, but in many ways there's really no rhyme or reason for this movie to exist, and yet it no. does, and we both love it.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. So, you know, forget Mad Max, the film with, you know, Melvin Gibson. This is a true Mad Max who has a lot of redeeming qualities despite his swallowing of a cat. And it's just lovable, a Shaggy Dog story with all the just so much fun, so much entertainment value. if we extended this podcast any longer, I would talk my way up to a 4. I'm going to hold off till 3.75. Love this film. Hope you guys love our podcast. We're going to undoubtedly investigate more animal attack movies, because as many of them as I've seen, and I think it's got to probably count in among at least 20 to 30, if not higher.
Probably more. It's one of the most fertile of all the subgenres, I would say.
I mean, I think,
the zombie subgenre in horror.
I've seen personally 4 alligator attack movies plus a Komodo dragon attack movie. So we're getting far, to the more far-flung, obscure creatures. But
don't forget the Gila monster.
Oh, yeah. Can't forget about the amazing Gila monster. And hopefully you won't forget about our show with new episodes uploaded for your listening enjoyment every Friday. And we hope you enjoy what you're hearing. Send us your favorite animal attack movie, because we're always game to talk about them. Reallyawfulmovies@gmail.com. We appreciate all our feedback, and we will talk to you soon.
Take care. Thank you.